You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 10th of February 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 188th edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Gillian De Bias.
On today's show, we'll meet Travis Elborough, the author of the book London Bridge in America, a story on what happened to London Bridge when it was sold to an American oil baron in the 1960s.
We'll also combine the rules of the economy with the rules of love, or try to, as we meet author William Nicholson, who's written a book called The Romantic Economist.
And getting a little more serious, we talk about British intelligence and what exactly it got up to during the Cold War and the twilight of the British Empire.
All that to look forward to, plus some great music and a news look ahead with Tom Edwards with his own theme tune, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome, listeners. It's noon Sunday here in London for us, isn't it, Gillian?
It is.
Last week, we were sat in the studio, weren't we, last Saturday, coming live on the Saturday
doing
the review. We'd never done a show together.
No, and
now
putting on my
are.
Headsets, I feel like you're the pilot, I'm the co-pilot, and we're about to take off on another great show.
To extend that analogy, and employ a filmic part of that analogy, I feel like Denzel Washington in Flight.
the alcoholic.
Don't say that! He's a pilot that has a bit of a problem keeping it on the, not in the air, but, well, kind of, yeah. He kind of saves lots
of
lives.
Them all.
He does
saves
it wonderfully.
Them all. Flawed, but a hero.
What
a
I meant
hero.
Was,
You're
I'm a flawed genius.
Hero. Monocle's very own flawed genius.
And yes, exactly. And here we are, a week later, the dream team has come back.
It's come back. But I'm going to desert you. I'm flying off after this and I'm heading to Berlin.
Oh, whatever. all right, well, we started talking about films. Maybe we should talk about that. Flight is a great film. Saw that a couple of weeks ago. It's a decent thing. I know last week on the review, you were waxing lyrical about Onegin, which you saw, which was really rather lovely.
As you said, culture with a capital C.
But
I am just trying to tick off all the Oscar films. So I saw Zero Dark Thirty, finally.
I've still yet to see that.
Brilliant.
I saw Park Chan-wook's new film. He of Old Boy fame, the film in which four octopuses were eaten by the actor. But this is Matthew Good and Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska, and it's this wonderful, beautiful kind of painterly piece of film, which is again has its very spooky moments. More about spiders than octopi this
oh,
time.
Oh, don't tell Hugo MacDonald.
I know, I won't. I'm glad.
Don't take him along.
I didn't hold his hand and skip merrily to the screening that day. I went on my own. So it's been a nice week, and also I saw the light show at the Haywood. It's kind of a week behind.
I'm dying to see that.
Trying to miss the crowds.
And?
The press crowds. I mean, it's a really beautiful thing. It's a really beguiling, strange show. I mean, all the sort of heroes are there. Kareth Wynne-Evans and Dan Flavin and all these sorts of people.
So is it design or art, light?
It's art. It's all light art. So it's all those fluorescent tubes. You didn't know whether they were leaning outside the building ready to be fitted or whether they were Dan Flavin artwork. They're the things you should have stolen, put in the back of your pickup truck and taken home. They're now worth £5 million.
And water too? Did you get wet?
There is a bit of water. The Olafur Eliasson work at the end, which is this beautiful strobe and water thing, which is very nice. But the security guards, I wouldn't say they're heavy-handed, but they certainly don't let you get your paws in the trough.
I thought the idea is you walk through it. It's the experience, no?
Oh, no, that's the rain room. I think that's the rain room.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
I have to go.
You'd have to be quite small to walk through this one. Douse your hair. Douse
you can
your
tell
hair
I'm
in it.
Yet.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm looking forward to today's show. Travis Elborough's coming in. We've had him on the Culture Show before. He's what they call a modern polymath, possibly. We'll put that to him and he'll probably look very embarrassed. Anyway, first up, though, we're going to speak to Tom Edwards. He's going to be peering into his news crystal ball.
Bringing you all the news you need. It's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
The more I hear that, the more I feel like it needs like a sort of Steve Wright zoo radio kind of clapping in the background after that.
I think we can.
We can do it ourselves, Rob.
Let's re-edit that. Re-edit for next week's show. Tom, welcome. What have you got in your news drawer?
Well,
your top drawer.
I want to start with tomorrow. You know, it's Monday. It's kind of start of the week. So let's begin with, you know, a fairly sober subject. It's the anniversary of the toppling of Hosni Mubarak. So 2 years on. This was, of course, after a huge number of demonstrations, increasing violence in Egypt, Mubarak was finally ousted during that revolution. And I just think it'll be an interesting one to watch because we've already seen the last couple of weeks with these different anniversaries that have been, we've seen it in Cairo and around Egypt, people, it tends to ferment feelings of frustration, both with the new regime directed at the current president. And it'll be just very interesting to see tomorrow whether this, another portentous day, whether that brings people out onto the streets and gets them, you know, active
in
the
following the assassination in Tunisia as well, how that plays.
Well, that's right. And it really feels, it's felt over the last week that the sort of the Arab Spring, you know, another fresh gust of energy and dissent has been sort of driven into it. So I just think it'll be very interesting to watch from Egypt. And we'll be keeping a weather eye on it here on Monocle 24, of course, as always.
And it's like also the power of an anniversary. It sort of crystallises feeling, doesn't it? I mean, you know, it's 1 year, it's 2 years, it's always kind of, it's always good to have a date
particularly
around which to assemble, I guess.
Well, and particularly if there's a feeling that things haven't changed as you would have wanted. And obviously it's been very difficult for Mohamed Morsi. He's still struggling at the moment to galvanise his own party, and there's a lot of dissatisfaction with, you know, that Islamist direction within Egypt. So, yeah, very interesting date tomorrow. What about something lighter?
Yeah, why not?
We can do light and shade on this show somewhere.
Well, haven't you?
This is something else happening tomorrow. I brought you a pictorial help.
Oh, good.
Illustrated news.
Can you go first? All right. Look at the little guy there. He's quite hard to spot in the middle of that picture.
Very hairy, dark face.
It's Robert Bounds.
It's
America's premier dog show, the Westminster Kennel Club show in New York. And I thought I should mention this because I get very excited when Crufts rolls around.
Where is it?
Here you go. It's like a hairy otter.
That's the reason I brought him in. He's last year's winner.
Oh.
2012.
Is that what's that's? It's a bit like a Pekingese.
It is a Pekingese.
Oh, it is a Pekingese.
Good spot, Robert.
Aren't I bloody good?
You're wasted here. You should be on the judging panel.
I will be. Yeah.
But all the regular mutts will be competing. They're in Madison Square Garden, of course, and it's a very ancient, lot of tradition. It's the 130-something tradition. You know, all the favourites there. The Fox Terrier, of course, my personal favourite,
along
with Andrew Tux.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll see the elegance, beauty, and grace of the canine athletes.
I should do a shout out for my parents' dog, George.
What kind of dog is George?
He's a Jack Russell. He'll be listening to this.
Nice.
Fact.
I like his master's voice.
Yeah.
Looking into the gramophone.
He'll be cocking his little folded up velvety ears at the radio as we speak.
I should point out that in America, this is considered a sporting event, which I find.
Well, it's basically reminding me of the Christopher Guest film Best in Show,
of course,
which is absolutely genius, and it is all that. I really feel that there should be a category, which is how much does the owner look like the dog?
Great idea.
I can imagine. Does George look a little bit like Robert Bound? I can imagine that he maybe
does.
Yeah,
he's a terrier.
Maybe slightly doesn't have the same kind
long
of
hair.
Quiff.
I've got wonderful hair today. It's really annoying having to wear the headphones because it's ruining my hair.
It's ruining your look.
Yeah. Anyway.
So shall we move on? But
yeah.
Why don't we keep it on that side of the Atlantic? On Tuesday, it's the State of the Union address. Always a big, you know, occasion. Lots more pomp and circumstance. We've seen that the last couple of weeks.
There's been some good big American events, haven't there? Lots of podium stuff.
That's right. And this is the latest.
Dias-tastic.
Well, there'll be more dias-sing occurring. I don't know if any of these things are real words. This is an opportunity, we understand from the White House Press Secretary, for Barack Obama to outline his proposal, particularly for immigration reform. This has been a real sort of hot ticket issue throughout the campaign, and something that in his early words when he had just re-inaugurated, one of the sort of things that he's really going to try and, you know, leave a legacy, leave a real lasting impact. So it'll be very interesting to see what he has to say. And I think it's always one of those ones where sometimes they can be overanalyzed, but I think in a second term, particularly where there's feelings that a president maybe hasn't quite delivered all that he might have in his first term, people will naturally read so much more into his rhetoric.
Well, especially with such an orator like Obama, which everyone, the expectations are so high.
Mine are sky high. If he doesn't deliver, I'm going to be very disappointed.
I'd give him a hat. He could email me the script. I'll have a go at it.
Just take a look.
I'll give it a once
give
over for him.
Yeah. Why not? Should offer that
up. Leave a bit more of a pause there, Barack. Pause for applause. He should do also, I'd recommend he do some impersonations. Maybe put on some dark glasses, do a Jack Nicholson. Well, thanks for coming, folks. Like that kind of thing. That maybe get more, and then that middle American voter.
You're wasted, Rob.
I'm not wasted yet. That'd be good, right? What do you think, Tom?
I'm all for that. I think there should be more impersonations. Maybe some kabuki theatre. Throw that in there. I've got one last thing to mention.
Right. Okay.
I feel, you know, we're Monocle 24. We're sort of a year and a bit, you know, into our radio existence.
Mm.
I figure we're rewriting the rule book for radio somewhat, modestly. but on Wednesday, it is actually International Radio Day.
Is it? On what day is it?
It is on Wednesday.
Okay.
So the United Nations, it's their educational, scientific and cultural organisation, UNESCO, of course, has proclaimed it as the day to celebrate radio broadcast and to improve international cooperation among radio broadcasters, which is, I figure, something we do that every day.
What should we do?
Just by giving the world our radio
goal. I think we should have a day off.
I'll sign up to that one immediately.
It's National Radio Day. Switch
champagne
it all off.
In
we're
the
going
studio.
Out the pub.
I vote for champagne in studio.
All right,
bubbly
well,
in studio.
Yeah, let's do that.
But a special day to mark. So that's on Wednesday.
Woo. Well, we should be doing that. Tom, thank you so much for coming in with your news agenda.
Pleasure as always.
A mixture of light and shade, and great that we got to talk about dogs.
I always try and include some canines if I can.
And do a Jack Nicholson impersonation.
I think you said Jack Russell impersonation.
Woof.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Thanks, Tom. You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Soon we'll be meeting Travis Elborough, author of new book on the story of London Bridge.
So, an iconic old bridge in London and an American businessman with barrels of money, writer, cultural commentator and author Travis Elborough has written a book on the multi-millionaire oil baron who bought London Bridge in 1968 and transplanted it to the middle of the Arizona desert.
And Travis joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
A pleasure to be here.
Now, this kind of story, this is a weird and wonderful story. It's a story about history. It's a story about big personalities. It's a story about America and Britain and the two nations divided by a common tongue as well.
Exactly, yeah.
It must be a dream.
And connected by an old bridge in this case.
Yeah, so this must be a dream to get your teeth into as a
historian. Very much
so,
yeah. I mean, it's just one of those apocryphal stories. The myth... And I'm giving the spoiler here, I'll basically say it's a myth.
May contain plot spoilers.
Exactly, may contain plot spoilers. Okay. The story that the Americans had bought the wrong bridge and they really wanted Tower Bridge is still in circulation and is much recounted in pubs and in cabs across the city of London. And I just really wanted to unpick that. I mean, the story I remember first hearing that this bridge had gone across to America as a small child learning the nursery rhyme and a school teacher saying, well, the real London Bridge is in America. And at that point in time, she might as well have said the moon. It just seemed such a kind of exotic and odd thing.
It's amazing how that stuck, because London Bridge, we all have so many different connotations and emotional attachments to it, regardless of where you live
in the world. Exactly. And because the nursery rhyme is so embedded into kind of childhood for almost globally. So that's the kind of the starting point for me as a kind of memory anyway.
And why did someone want to buy London Bridge, whether it's Tower Bridge or London Bridge, nonetheless, something that spanned the Thames, very famous, it's got a nursery rhyme about it. What was the motivation?
I mean, it's almost the other way around. It's the fact that it was put up for sale. It in itself is odd.
Which is an odd thing.
Yeah, I mean, it grows out of an interesting period in global history as much as anything else, that it's put up for sale by the Corporation of London in 1967. Essentially, when it's first built in 1831, it's the heaviest thing in London. It's 130,000 tons of granite.
That's a good fact as well.
Yeah.
It's the heaviest thing in London.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And by the 1960s, it's sinking into the mud of the Thames by about an eighth of an inch each year. It's also at a point where car ownership is rising, a desire, in a sense, to recreate London, as this happens across the globe, really, as a modern, metopian kind of city. And at this point in time, there were plans to erect motorways through some of the famous kind of thoroughfares of London, rebuild them and recast them in this vein, recasting them in quite an American way, like Los Angeles almost.
But how did they get the idea to just, sell it and sell it to rich, crazy Americans, other than knock it down and just use the bridge?
Well, again, this is the thing, that you have the first stirrings of the preservation movement in the kind of early 1960s. The famous case in London about the destruction of a thing called the Euston Arch, which is this sort of early 19th century portico stone entrance to Euston Arch, which is destroyed by the British Transport Commission in 1961. And there's outrage that this historic item is being destroyed. So you get, there's a slight edging up to the idea of preservation, and that the idea of this thrust for modernity in modern cities is eating away and at some kind of historical element. And there's also a point where people start to realise the idea of heritage having some sort of value. So that's kind of how it ends up being up for sale. But the idea of selling it comes down to one man, this rather debonair city politician, a character called Ivan Luckin, who's a former journalist and press agent and publicity manager. And he is the first person who dreams up this idea. And his idea, in a sense, is also inspired by William Randolph Hearst, the famous model of Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, who for years had been sweeping up architectural treasures from across the globe and across Europe, and then having them kind of shipped to his sumptuous hacienda in Northern California called San Sebastian and recreated. Hearst is kind of the key that Luckin kind of latches onto as an idea that some mad American may possibly be interested in this old landmark. And again, it goes up for sale in 67, so just about the time of Time magazine have done their swinging London, and what the film critic Alexander Walker called the love everything British phenomena is at its peak. So the idea of buying a piece of ye olde Britain is much more appealing at that particular juncture. I mean, the year in which the sale is agreed, May 1968, to return to film slightly, Oliver wins the best picture offer. And this is in 1968, when the riots are going on in Paris, and we think of the Vietnam protests against Grosvenor Square at the American embassy, and all of these calamitous kind of events. Martin Luther King is assassinated and so on. And yet, here is the best picture award going to this musical tale of Cockney wallop swipers. So, it's quite an odd period. Yeah.
You told us about Ivan Luckin, the London guy. The other end of the connection is obviously one of the other obviously huge personalities is in the book is Robert McCulloch, the guy who buys the bridge, who is a chainsaw entrepreneur.
Yes.
Now this is we kind of have this idea. You say that sort of mad rich Americans buy things and transport them. This was a sort of British Empire thing as well when Leighton House was built. I guess maybe we didn't think it was quite so nutty, despite its
no, exactly.
architectural thing. But what was the relationship between those two men, like between McCulloch and Luckin?
McCulloch is again this immensely flamboyant figure. I mean, he effectively invents the one person operated chainsaw, makes a killing out of that. His business partner in this, so they're almost the kind of three figures in this story, or the central figures in the story. His business partner is a man called C.V. Wood. Now, Wood has developed theme parks and was actually partly responsible for Disneyland, although fell out.
The
with...
chainsaw theme park is yet to be realised. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If anyone's listening to this, this is going straight on Dragon's Den.
Yeah,
I can see it happening. Yeah. I think Lumber Town, as it?
Everyone's missing a thumb.
Exactly.
In Lumber Town.
But yeah, so I mean, C.V. Wood, he the designer builder of Disneyland. He's also a championship chili chef.
It sounds like a magic realist novel.
Exactly.
I'm listening to these characters and they're so larger than life. I'm already casting it in my head. Well, Did you ever think of doing a film instead of a book?
No, I'd love to do some sort of... I mean, again, it lends itself so well to that because it also ends rather badly for McCulloch. McCulloch's amasses this huge business empire. He's not only content with being an oil baron and a chain, so part of the reason why they buy the bridge is because they're developing this whole new city out in the desert, Lake Havasu City.
As one
does, yeah. I mean, and his initial impetus to that is he's getting taxed heavily in kind of zoning laws, new zoning laws in Los Angeles, so he wants to relocate one of his plants. I mean, he also owns an outboard motor company, and he has an outboard motor testing site on the lake, in Lake Havasu, and then he thinks, oh, well, hell, why not? Let's just build an entire new city and I can move the plant there and we can create this whole kind of, McCulloch town world out there. And that's what they do. And London Bridge, in a way, is the sort of icing on the cake of it. It's the thing, to make it into a fully-fledged resort. And at the foot of London Bridge, when they relocate it and rebuild it, they also create this ersatz English village, this Cockney theme park town with a kind of ye olde English pub. And
well in Garden City.
Well, exactly. Yeah, so cements this place as this kind of resort. I mean, today, Lake Havasu City is still in existence and the rest of it, but it's Americans will know it, if they know it about the bridge, will know it more, actually, the place where people go for their spring break.
Right.
And it's a huge kind of going wet and wild in the water park.
And what is underneath? What is underneath? What flows beneath London Bridge now?
Water does flow below it now, but we should probably explain that when it was first erected, it was erected over dry land.
Yes, because I've seen these pictures.
Yeah, exactly. The thing about the bridge as well is that it's the bridge itself, what they've got over in Lake Havasu City in Arizona is 10,000 tons worth of the bridge. So they've got essentially the fascia of the bridge. And then there's a kind of a purpose-built frame was erected onto which that's added. And the bridge itself is hollow, and bats float around inside of it, as well as lots of kind of wiring and sewage.
It's very theme park, isn't it?
Exactly.
You think it's a haunted house. You think it's a runaway train mountain. It turns out to be polystyrene and wiring.
Exactly.
And this is kind of an interesting thing about the veracity of artifacts as well, I suppose, as well, isn't it? What's real and what's fake? And if you build it in the desert, is it still London Bridge? Do you explore this a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the other thing that the book attempts to consider, and I think London Bridge is almost an exemplar of this, is that we've got quite used to this idea of former industrial premises, you know, like warehouses being turned into flats or
factories.
Yeah, exactly. And so on. And this version of using old kind of defunct industrial buildings to do something else with is sort of summed up in really the approach that what McCulloch and Wood do with London Bridge. They make it the centre of this theme park to a certain extent, but it's also indicative of what will happen in cities across the globe, that there'll be more about tourism, there'll be less about industry, and there'll be about leisure, and the heritage will be part of its selling point.
As well as writing the book, you've done something quite interesting, which is kind of like a soundscape for the book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We've done a couple of things in collaboration with a company called Melodical and a gentleman called Alex Mayer, who's responsible for that company. The first thing we did, which was to almost try and create a radio trailer for the book. And to do that, you were saying earlier on about how the characters are so vivid. So one of the things we did was to actually have a kind of minor dramatization element of the book. But all the way I was researching the book and reading the book, I was seeking out films, music and other things. And so we've put some of those elements together in this audio trailer. And the idea is you get something, you know, like a little taster for what might be contained within the book.
What you're saying is we're not good enough. Not so. Does it contain the line, "A bridge in the desert, you must be mad"?
Should we have a listen?
Let's have a listen, yeah.
Gentlemen, we've been over this at the last meeting.
All I'm saying is...
We know your position, Mr. Luckin. You expressed yourself on the point with great clarity at our last session.
But, Mr. Chairman, it's a win-win. I don't know why you can't see it. Yanks need a slice of history. We need a new bridge.
It is not and never will be the remit of the Bridge House Estates Committee to dream up ways of turning a fast buck.
The bridge is coming down, coming down, coming down. London Bridge is coming down. It's off to Arizona. London Bridge is coming down.
I'm Travis Elbra, and my latest book is London Bridge in America, the tall story of a transatlantic crossing. This charts one of the oddest events in Anglo-American history, the sale of John Rennie's 19th century London Bridge to the United States in 1968.
England swings like a pendulum do, Bobby's own bicycles two by two, Westminster Abbey, the Tower of Big Ben, the rosy red cheeks of the little children.
I wanted to ask you, this kind of fits into quite a niche of brilliant ideas for books that you've had, Travis. I mean, we've had it on the culture show talking about vinyl revival and all the rest of it. Did you think of all these ideas in order as such? Were these all these things crowding out your mind, your pain to the Routemaster bus as well, for example?
Well, I mean, the Routemaster bus is something to do with the element of this book, actually, which is that I was always told that there was a Routemaster bus at the foot of London Bridge out in Arizona, and so I intrigued enough to go and try and find it out there as much as anything else. And when I got there, I discovered that actually it had been banished to a breaker's yard, and you know, its engine had been removed and so on. And so that seemed similar fate is about to befall the English village, which is about to be replaced.
Yeah, is that
replaced.
Still there? So McCulloch Town, is it still there? And is it still as popular a tourist spot as it was in '68 when Oliver was out and all the rest of it?
Well, Yes and no. In a sense, it's settled into being a fixture of the town.
It's now essentially
a bridge. Yeah, it's always gone back to being kind of a mundane object. Yeah, bridge in the desert over some water. Yeah. I mean, I was told the biggest draw in a sense of Lake Havasu City is the lake itself. It's a town where people go, you know, fishing, boating, powerboarding, and all these types of quite outdoorsy sports are its main impetus. But we have to think in a way the bridge is almost like the starter yeast of this resort. Anyway, and it's kind of evolved in its own way and settled in a way into being a kind of more obviously Western American town, which is in a way how it started. Because, I mean, people I interviewed who were the pioneers, you know, they were living in tents in the desert when they're trying to establish this place before the bridge. And they heard the bridge was being about to be transported. They put a sign up in the desert where the bridge, future bridge, was about to land, saying no fishing off the bridge. It was just in this kind of barren patch
of
sand.
I suspect it's not the only surreal moment in the book. At the time being, Travis Elber, author of London Bridge in America. Thank you very much for coming on The Weekly.
A very good pleasure. Thank you.
Next up on The Weekly, we'll meet William Nicholson, who's written a story of an economics student who decides to apply the rules of economics to save his love life that's seen better days. The author himself has also been an economics student, so we might have to ask just how autobiographical that book is. Before that, we're going to have some music. This is new from Caitlin Rose. It's from the upcoming album called The Stand-In. There's a lovely track called I Was Cruel. And that was I Was Cruel from Caitlin Rose. That's from the upcoming album called The Stand-In. And if you want to know how to write a love song, she has written a piece for us in the February issue about how to do just that. It's something that's eluded me, Gillian.
You keep trying, though.
I keep trying. I keep strumming away. Anyway, right now, you're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Pounds, and Gillian DeBias.
And we're going to be back in a moment with William Nicholson. He's the author of The Romantic Economist, a how-to self-help book that applies the cold rules of market forces to everyday relationships. Don't miss that.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Now, can the rules of economics and the relative certainty of numbers be put to work in matters of the heart? Do supply and demand work in the arena of romance? Can assets be valued numerically and dispassionately when they'd normally be called someone's good points?
Our next guest, William Nicholson, is an economist with a love life like the Dow Jones, off the scale one minute, triple dipping the next. And he's written a book about it, The Romantic Economist, a story of love and market forces. William joins us now.
Hi there. Thanks.
Stop flirting with him, Gillian. This is meant to be... Only joking, of course.
I mean, is this autobiographical? Tell us. How true is this to
you? I've got to be very careful what I say here. I'd say semi-autobiographical. Actually, I'd say slightly less than semi. It's an amalgamation. It's based on an amalgamation of my own personal experiences, which I've kind of jumbled up, so you can't possibly identify anyone in the book.
And friends, he says diplomatically.
Yes, yes.
So people are called, that are called Rachel in real life are called Raquel in your book. Stuff like that. Well hidden, exactly. Well hidden metaphors.
Exactly. There is a character called Freddie who's actually his middle person. I'm basing it on his middle name is in fact Freddie.
Okay.
And he told hasn't seen you.
And let's get to the nub of it. It's a fantastic idea for a book. Whether the rules of economics apply to the rules of love. You kick off by talking a lot about supply and demand, as we talked about in our introduction. Tell us a little bit about this. Is this the kind of treat and mean, keep and keen school of
Yeah, precisely.
Sort of love.
Yeah, no, I really got thinking about this idea in great detail.
Yeah.
When I was, I'd just been dumped, and I was just trying to kind of work out why on earth, like, I thought I'd been really nice and just, like, you know, taking care of her. And somehow, the more I did that, the more distant she became. Yeah. I thought, this makes
not working.
Absolutely no sense. So I spoke to the wisest person I know, which is my mum, about these things. Nope, sorry, William, you just got to play the game. And it's like, what? How on earth can that work?
Is it dispiriting when your mum says that to you, though? You're sort of like, really, mother?
Oh, no, exactly. She was a bit of a dark horse in her day. But I got thinking about it. So, because in terms of kind of, if you're thinking, I want to make myself more attractive in your product, then you would think, right, I need to actually reduce my price, you know, bargain basement prices. And so, actually, but when you decrease your supply, play hard to get, your price will actually increase. But nonetheless, it's deemed to be like an attractive thing to be hard to get. And so I just kind of tried to work out what kind of product we are, which makes us more attractive the more expensive we are.
So you've got to kind of pitch yourself as a rare luxury brand.
Precisely, yeah, no, okay. Exactly. So I kind of compare it to if you're going to buy a handbag, you don't want everyone to see you've got a kind of Primark piece of rubbish, because like you'll just be seen as, you know, someone, you know, cheap, basically. So you want to kind of like set yourself out from everyone else.
But not being too flashy, of course.
Exactly, but not being too flashy.
It's having a navy blue Ferrari. You don't want a red one, you want a navy blue one.
But how did you go about starting to test drive your theory? Test driving the Ferrari metaphor there.
Test driving the Ferrari. I myself, in reality, never did. I mean, the character in the book, he actually shares my name, which is slightly confusing.
Paul Osterberg.
Yeah, he tries to put it into practice in a nightclub. And so, right, it's going to be hard to get. I'm going to be, you know, tucked away in a corner. Or someone starts talking to me, I'm going to kind of get their attention, but then immediately withdraw. He tries to do it, and it just completely falls flat. It doesn't work at all. And so then I started thinking about why exactly that would be. Why can't you just play hard to get from the off? I realised the reason was, when someone doesn't know you and you play hard to get, you're just like, well, I don't know who you are. Yes. I can't be bothered to like chase you around.
So you've got to do an advertising campaign and then
exactly
boast about your scarcity, I suppose.
Well. Exactly. And so, yeah, well, once you've kind of shown that you're an individual with some particular qualities that perhaps are harder to come by, that's when you can start kind of restricting your supply.
Now, one of the phrases that jumped out at me, and I can't wait to take this book away and read it properly. I will have to let listeners into the secret that I have skimmed only this book. But one phrase jumped out at me: efficient market hypothesis. That maybe some of our listeners who might be economists, certainly work in the financial sector, will know what that means. What does that mean, and how can that be applied to the arena of romance?
Yeah, the efficient market hypothesis is quite simple, really. It's the basic.
I hate it when people come
in
here and say
that. That's a bad start. I'm very sorry.
A comet, darling. It's very simple, darling.
Yeah. So if you just take the arena it's usually applied is just a stock market. If everyone knows everything and has equal access to information and is trading those stocks, then in theory the price of the stock should actually reflect how much it's actually worth. In other words, there won't be any assets which are undervalued or overvalued. Everything will be the exact fair price. Which means you can't get a bargain, basically. If something appears to be like, oh my God, this is a fantastic stock, I can't believe it's so cheap, and you go and buy it, and it crashes. It's like, well, that's why it was so cheap in the first place.
So how does this work with girls and boys?
Yeah, so this this is actually one of the theories which didn't go down so well in my personal experience. Is, say, for instance, you've been at university for a few years, and you think you pretty much... You know, you've given the market a good scouting, and you just don't think there's anything out there.
Yeah.
And suddenly, out of nowhere, this incredible girl comes along and just totally sweeps you off your feet. And you think this is slightly strange. Like, she's absolutely perfect and really likes me. Like, what on earth is going on? Particularly like the fact that no one else has even heard of her or even seen her. But yet she's really into me. And so in the book, this is exactly what happens to William in the book. Where he thinks he's really onto something, they get on really well, and then they go out on a night out together where it all ends horribly, involving kind of girls passing out in loos and that kind of stuff.
Does he draw a graph at any point in the book?
There are multiple graphs in the book.
Well, that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at these great graphs and books, and we have everything from Keynesian love and pictures of hearts and broken hearts. And then there's one graph which I quite like. I'd like you to explain how to hide the crazy.
Yes, hiding the crazy. Yeah, that's another one, slightly more controversial theories in the book.
What's this? This sounds good. I'm going to get some T-shirts printed with this on.
That'd be fantastic. It'd be good. The idea of hiding the crazy is, I think I'm definitely not alone in saying this. So when you first start going out with a girl, they are the most incredible people you'll ever meet. They are so kind of generous and forgiving, and like if you kind of screw up or if you're just like untidy, or, you know, you haven't had a shower for a few days, they're just like, they don't say a thing about it. They're just like, oh, don't you worry about it. I don't mind. Whereas over time,
they start minding.
You start having your kind of habits, kind of, you know, really criticised, and they start kind of trying to mould you into a kind of a perfect boyfriend. And so I term that in the book hiding the crazy, which is when in the first few months of relationship, or even weeks if you're unlucky. So they put it up, so they hide the crazy. But then over time, because you are growing so much, so attached to them, it means that they can get away with punishing you for your shortcomings.
And what sort of market is the author of this book in at the moment? Is it a bull market? Is it a bear market? I'm trying to think of a third animal. I don't know whether there is one. Is it the year of the snake? Where are we now?
In my personal life, so I'm feeling pretty bullish at the moment.
Okay.
Love life has never been better.
Is this something to do with having a book out?
I would be lying if I said I didn't once or twice use it as a chat up.
And I see for your author photo there, you've gone for the approachable, the affable.
So yeah,
you don't look like an economist there. You look
like seriously chilled out.
Yeah, that's fine. That's all right. So we should. So what do you want us to do? Put out your mobile number and an email address on the radio.
Well,
as well?
I'm sad to say I have. Oh, very happy today, I should say. I have a girlfriend, a lovely girlfriend.
The book works, ladies and gentlemen. The book is The Romantic Economist: A Story of Love and Market Forces. The author is William Nicholson. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Our next guest has written a book that is the first book devoted to British intelligence during the twilight of empire that's been based on declassified intelligence reports. So it says, undoubtedly, there's been a lot of research on what the security and intelligence services were up to in that period, starting from the beginning of the 20th century all the way to the Cold War.
The Empire of Secrets offers a compelling new chapter in the history of Britain's last days of the empire. And the author of the book, historian Calder Walton, joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I have to ask you, first off, it's just the research and the kind of documents you had access to tell the story.
Indeed. Well, all in all, it took me 10 years to write the book from the point when I started a master's in Cambridge. This topic really sort of emerged at the end of my PhD, and then I sort of carried on with it in a postdoc. And the point is that actually there are so many records out there now sitting in the National Archives that you're almost spoiled for choice. And it seems that every record you pick up, there's a wonderful story to be told. So really, 20 years ago, you couldn't have written a book like this. The records simply weren't available. But I'm really now, and other people working in the field, there's almost too many records to work with. So it's been a a happy problem to deal with.
I guess, and I guess it changes the sort of book you write. You become revisionist of the stuff that was out 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And it's, in many ways, what I try to do is to write the first word, definitely not the final word. I'm sure people will come along and correct me in areas that I'm wrong on. But there are so many records that apparently are still under lock and key somewhere in Whitehall that we don't have access to. And hopefully one day more will come out and the full story will be able to be told.
So what are the kind of revelations? What are the things that really surprised you?
Well, I think that the number one thing, there were two things that struck me when I started the research. First of all, I was blown away by the threat of Jewish or Zionist terrorism relating to Palestine in the immediate post-war years, 1945, 46, 47. And actually, from the perspective of British intelligence, this was a much greater threat than the Cold War, the Soviet Union. So actually, when you start to look at it through their eyes at the time, the early Cold War, the onset of the Cold War, looks completely different than it does to us today. And this urgent threat of terrorist plots in Britain that really hardly a ripple sort of appeared on the newspapers at the time or anything in the public domain, but was all going on in the background, it really is an exciting, fascinating new story, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, the history of the secret services of any country is always a fascinating thing because the idea is that you shouldn't notice it's there.
Precisely.
You know, all the false bottoms and newspapers with holes in
them. That's just right? It, exactly.
Yeah. You should know it's there, but of course it's that sort of unsubtle, I guess we have that unsubtle James Bond image in our
exactly,
head
exactly,
well.
Behind the scenes, quietly working away.
Yeah.
And it's just the whole point is that's why I think it's important not to get drawn into discussions about, I'm very reluctant to get into discussions about what's going on today, because the 10 years that took me to write this book, one thing I walked away with is there's all this stuff going on behind the scenes 50, 60 years ago. God only knows what's going on today. So, it's quite a sort of morals for today as well.
And I wanted to ask you, thematically, the book sort of is about Britain's climbing down from empire,
right,
handing power to the nation states that grew up.
That's right.
And how did the security services, led from London, I suppose, handle that sort of breakdown?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think the point is to be said that nowhere in the British government was this a sort of a pre-formulated plan. So in many ways, it was the sort of the classic British improvisation. Well, we'll just make it up as we go along. But what the intelligence services were able to do is to provide, I think, really valuable and crucial intelligence on some of the leaders of these independent states that gained independence from Britain. And you asked me earlier what I was surprised about. And really, the second big thing that I was extraordinarily surprised by was that the intelligence reports they produced were almost always extremely sober and calm. And it was actually non-alarmist. And you would think, because I approached this somewhat skeptically, thinking, well, the intelligence services, dare I say it, probably have a vested interest in sexing up, to use a phrase that we've heard quite a bit of recently. They probably have
a dossier with a piece of lace around it.
Exactly. They have a vested interest in sexing up a dossier.
Yeah.
But actually what we find is that the old saying, armies will always ask for more tanks, won't they? But actually what you find is that they're producing intelligence reports on people like Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya. And lots of other people in London and in Washington are saying, oh my God, he must be a communist. What are we going to do? We can't possibly trust him. And you've got the intelligence services saying, we've got absolutely nothing on our radar to show that he's anything more than left-leaning. And there's no evidence that he's a communist. And the reasons we now can see why they were able to produce such good intelligence is because they had the Communist Party of Great Britain completely bugged and under wraps.
Right.
Their telephone calls were being monitored. And they knew from at source, they said, you know, the communist leaders were saying, well, we can't trust them.
So. Talking of bugging, I was reading an interesting bit about the bugging and the interference that fluorescent lights can cause. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
There was a Soviet bug, I forget which year now, in the early 1950s, that was discovered in the Great Seal of the United States Embassy. And it was a present that had been given by the Soviet ambassador, I think I'm right in saying, in London to the US ambassador. They realized that something was going wrong when the US ambassador's voice was found broadcasting in a completely different room within the embassy. And then they brought in some sweepers, I guess, and they found this huge, great big sort of Soviet bug. And this set off alarm bells. And what they found is that these things were probably operating through fluorescent lights in some way, in some sort of way. I can't quite figure out myself. I'm not a scientist. But it does beg the question, maybe that's why there's so many fluorescent lights in Whitehall departments at the moment.
One of the things that I guess comes out of the book, just the title itself, is who's in charge? I always wonder how the intelligence services work, irrespective of the government that's in power, the defence budget, etc., etc. It seems to be one of those things that is a there is a line that runs from 1909, the foundation of the service, till now.
Yeah.
And I wonder who affects it.
You're talking about
accountability? In terms of political leadership, it sort of has a life of its own, is that
well,
true?
Well, the point is that the intelligence services were set up as bodies of the state, not depending on a particular government. And absolutely. But the weird thing is, it's sort of peculiarly British, and I should say that I'm half American, so I do have a sort of slight outsider's perspective on this. Unlike the CIA, for example, that when it was set up in 1947, was immediately given statutory footing. For most of the 20th century, the British intelligence services didn't have any kind of official recognition on the part of the British government. So they sort of limped along, if you like, in the dark. And it did mean that there are all sorts of suspicions and conspiracies could grow up about them, because the point is that there just weren't the records available.
Yeah.
I think that I'm right in saying is that the way the intelligence services feel about it now is that since the early 1990s, when they were finally put on a statutory basis and recognized, I mean, now they've all got websites, that actually now maybe some of the conspiracy theories about what the intelligence services do can finally be sort of displaced. I'm afraid License to Kill and so on is fictional.
There are some dark spots obviously uncovered in the book, and I think resonant to our times now on the topic of torture. And I wonder if you can rendition as well, I gather.
Definitely. Well, I was quite, again, surprised to find in the Second World War a sort of a curious episode of, we all know about Bletchley Park and the decrypts and the Enigma code. And what I found was that decrypts from Bletchley Park identified a number of German agents in different parts of the British Empire. And it then became a question of, well, they needed them to be detained and possibly interrogated and hopefully turned into double agents. But the question then was, well, how could they go about doing that? And they wanted them brought to Britain in order to be interrogated. But the lawyers in MI5 and the Home Office and the Foreign Office and the Colonial Office said, well, can't really just do that. That's kidnapping.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, so, no inverted commas necessary.
No, exactly. Yeah. There's no common law or statutory ability for us to be able to do this. But they were at war, so they were able to pass some ad hoc legislation, and it was able to be done. But it does have some striking sort of contemporary resonances, I think, about allegations made about what the intelligence services are doing today in the so-called war on terror. Emphasis on the word allegations.
Yeah, yeah. We'll flag that up. We'll put that in bold. From all that research, 10 years of writing the book, do you feel that Britain knows more and knew more about its enemies or its friends?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, it depends on when you're talking about, I think. During the Second World War, it was focusing on its enemies, but actually our friends were targeting us. In other words, the Soviet Union.
Everyone's looking over their shoulder.
Exactly. That's a really good question. I mean, there isn't anything really too much out there on what British intelligence thought about the US intelligence community at different points. But I think that we'd probably be quite naive to think that they weren't making assessments of our cousins on the other side of the pond. And vice versa, of course. Is there such a thing as a friendly secret service? I'm not sure.
Now, you're a Cambridge graduate, Oxbridge. Of course, it was the breeding ground of spies.
Indeed.
Do you get a sense of where do the new spies come from?
Well, my old college in Cambridge is Trinity, and that was the home of four of the five Cambridge spies.
Yeah.
So it was quite an appropriate place to be sort of studying it. And the nice statistic that I like about Trinity College, Cambridge, is they like to say that they produce more Nobel Prize winners than any other Oxbridge or academic institution, I think I'm right saying, in the world. What they don't like to say is that they've probably produced more traitors than any other academic institution in the world. And another statistic I really like is that on the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, in all of the British intelligence services, I think there was one or two graduates of a British university. In other words, they were all military types. But the perverse situation was, because of the Cambridge spies who were working for the KGB, the KGB actually had more graduates of British universities working for it than Britain's own intelligence services did.
That's so good. Again, that's
quite a perverse situation, I think we can say.
Soviet finishing school.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Calder Walton, thank you very much for joining us. The book is Empire of Secrets. It's out now. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
And that is it for edition 188, Gillian, of the Monocle Weekly. Nice show, huh?
Nice show. Fun show. I'll do it again with you, Rob.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The Dream
yeah.
Team. Give me five.
Give you five. Woo!
There we are. That's pretty good.
Good show.
We should thank our lovely guest, Calder Walton, the historian. He was good.
Very good.
We could have talked for a long time about spies and false bottoms, couldn't we?
I want to look through all the papers and the old photographs. I have a new second career there. I want to be a spy researcher.
Gillian by a spy master. We should thank William Nicholson, who's the romantic economist.
Yes, he was good too. Yes.
I'm taking
we'll
that
be
book.
Following
I'm taking that book
the
home.
Marriage announcements, and I'm going to see how that goes.
Exactly. And Travis Elber, always great on the London Bridge in the middle of Arizona. He's always a great radio presence, isn't he?
Yeah.
Good voice.
And I want to see what his next book is.
A good voice. I know. Who knows? Yeah. Who knows where it might take him? Yeah. He's a sort of Renaissance man. He's a bit of a Renaissance man, Travis. We should thank our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, and Jack Phillips, our studio manager. And it just remains for me, Gillian, to say thank you for you, for helming
thank you
as well.
For you.
And we'll be back same time next week. For the time being, for me, Robert Pound.
And me, Gillian Tobias.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.